Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Oakley Dokley neighbors, I'm Corey Knockreiner.
In today's episode, we're going to talk about a hijacked JavaScript library that was used to attempt to steal cryptocurrency.
And then Crypto-what's-its?
Yeah, cryptocurrency.
Back in my day, I used paper money with numbers on them.
And then for our main section, we are going to discuss our 2019 predictions that didn't quite make the cut. And with that, let's
So we're in. Going to discuss the trash with our listeners. Is yeah. that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yep. No substance, no usability at all. Just going to spew words.
Par for the course, guys.
Let's get into the news. And before we can actually talk about the news story, I think there's some things we have to go over first, technical-wise. And the first off is...
Deets, y'all.
It revolves around a JavaScript application or a JavaScript library. And when we usually talk about JavaScript, most people think about client-side JavaScript that runs in your web browser. Like you go to a website and it downloads JavaScript to, say, display an ad or validate form input before you send it back off to the website. That isn't actually the only use that JavaScript has. Lately, there's been a lot of folks using JavaScript on the server side as well.
Absolutely.
And there's a specific runtime environment for it called Node that is very popular. We use it for a lot of our stuff, like our Capture the Flag contest. The website used Node as the backend server for
it. Crimson Thorn. Exactly. And by the way, I guess if we're jumping in right away, we should say that the first thing about this story is it probably affects web developers
and
the victim
too.
We will get to more than the average user, unless you might happen to be a user of this web developer, although we'll learn later that this particular thing doesn't necessarily target the users of this app.
Yep. So the Node runtime environment.
This JavaScript, which could be in other apps.
Yes. The Node runtime environment has a package manager, like a lot of other development environments. It's called NPM, and it basically acts as a repository for shared code. It can be open source libraries, can be even private packages. And developers that use Node use NPM to import shared libraries, basically. Like if you want something that can... create a piece of data or a data storage of a very specific type, there's probably a package for it.
Pretty much when you're coding, someone's created, you know, these libraries are made of functions or methods depending on what language, and you need to open a UI window, you need to ask for some data. There's no reason a coder needs to reinvent the wheel every time they're doing that type of stuff. So, I mean, half of coding is learning these libraries of pre-compiled code that does a lot of the basics for you as you're building something.
Like we have libraries that like interface with our database, things like that. So there's a very popular package out there called EventStream that has 2 million downloads per week, which in terms of Node packages is substantial.
A lot of developers must use it if it gets that many per week.
Yep, it's really popular, but it's actually hasn't really been maintained. Up until just a few months ago, there hadn't been an update for it in over 2 years.
In hindsight, by the way, we should talk about this from open source code in general. I mean, you and I think both like open source code, and it sometimes gets, I think, a somewhat false impression of being capable of or of being more secure in some cases. But while there's things that allow open source code to be more reviewed, the issue with it is when it's some free code some guy is or gal has built, you know, you never know when it's going to get antiquated and just disappear or lose maintainers. So there's been a lot of issues security-wise in the past that have to do with open source projects just kind of getting stale.
Yep. So the EventStream package hadn't been updated in 2 years. And then some unknown individual contacted the original author and said, hey, I will maintain the module for you. Is that cool? And the author said, yeah, I'm kind of over it. I don't feel like working on it. So here you go. And he relinquished full publishing control to this individual. It then turned out that that guy went and added a malicious sub-package to it called FlatMapStream that had very specific functionality. So even though this was a package that was used 2 million downloads a day by a whole bunch of different other applications, this sub-module he added specifically looked for Bitcoin wallets using a library called Copay. Copay is used in web applications. It's used in mobile phone apps, which can use Node as well. This malicious code would iterate over wallets that were found on the device that it's running on or the server it's running on, and look for wallets that had a pretty high balance of Bitcoin. I think it was looking for like over 100 Bitcoin, which is a ton of money. Yeah.
No. And even in today's drop standards, still, I don't know, is it still
like 2 million bucks or something? I think.
What's the single Bitcoin? Is it still in the
bucks?
Oh, it's 2,000.
2,000 or 3,000. It's dropped a ton.
6,000 last time I looked. Yeah. It keeps dropping.
Did you look at like 8 o'clock this morning? Because it probably dropped like that just in one day. Oh, anyways, wow. He also had man in the middle code for the wallet library itself, where once he identified wallets that had a high balance, if the owner of that wallet went to go unlock it, like to make a transaction or view it, he would capture the password and the private key and then send them off to his own server. This really was a interesting example of a different type of supply chain attack, yeah, where they're using a very popular application, convinced someone to relinquish control because they
I think that's mostly the new thing. I mean, we've seen open source packages that actually allow a lot of open source, allow open development, open people to submit changes.
Yep.
So it's not the first time open source has been backdoored in some way, but the whole way that they relinquish control with seemingly little to no validation of the new person was the newest and most interesting thing in my opinion.
And that's a good point. And it made quite a few people online very angry that the original author just gave up control like that. And
on the flip side, it should get, I mean, I think one thing that's not talked about with open source is millions of people down to even us, although I would say we go with more mature packages and we do follow it and maintain it. A lot of people just blindly start using libraries that over time get popular, mm-hmm, and you just assume it's always going to be safe. No one ever goes and validates the code. So, well, obviously the attacker in this case is the worst person, but really, why are you letting yourself use this random library that you have not validated by some third-party source in your critical web application or mobile application, whatever it is? It's something the community needs to think about.
And everyone really was playing the blame game in this, blaming the original author for giving control.
Yeah.
Obviously, blaming the random guy that inserted the malicious code. And then other people were blaming folks that use the library,
yes,
for not vetting the code in the first place.
I kind of go, I mean, I think the blame always lies on the attacker. But to be honest, the guy that created the original code, I mean, a lot of open source free, out of the kindness of his heart, often pet projects that maybe you do get bored with.
Yep.
How is it his responsibility to maintain it for people that are using it for their own business or private purposes?
And I agree with that.
Yeah. So I do think some of the onus is on the development community to somehow validate the code they're using.
And yeah, I'm in the same boat. I use a whole lot of different, I mean, NPM packages specifically, a whole bunch of different libraries.
By the way, I'm throwing stones from my glass house because I use libraries out there all the time.
I will admit,
but this made me think about it.
Yeah, I will admit I don't review the code all the time either before I import it because I just assume that if there's 2 million downloads a week, it can be trusted. But I also don't develop very, very sensitive applications that hold potentially millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin. So I think there is still some onus on you as a developer where if you are creating an app that's critical, you probably should review the libraries that you bring in manually.
And if we're going like a easier practical tip, maybe it's not super critical app you're developing or you're a one-person indie team and you literally, you know, to be viable, you can't look at every line of open source code you use, especially for all the basic stuff you happen to do in everyday coding. At the very least, think about the packages you choose. So for example, the Apache organization, mm-hmm, technically open source, but that's a well-maintained, kind of controlled by this Apache group, a team of people. It has really strong monitors, really strong people, you know, taking in new code samples, checking in code, that kind of stuff, versus some of these one-off, they end up being very popular, but they could just be one-off JavaScript packages that some person made. So I think maybe things you can look at were last time the GitHubs or whatever repository you get it from has been updated. Maybe do a little bit of research in who maintains certain libraries or code pieces you're using. And if it's someone like the Apache group, maybe you can lighten up on the validation and put some of the, I mean, you can't give them the liability, you're accepting it, but you're kind of trusting that Apache knows what they're doing. But if it's a single individual, maybe that's the code sample you want to be more careful with.
And I'd also say if you're a developer of open source software, while it isn't entirely your fault if you give up control to someone else, there are technically better ways of doing it where you can archive your project that you no longer care to maintain. Someone else can fork it.
Yes.
And maintain it themselves under a new name.
Yep.
That happens all the time. And
GitHub's very regularly.
And it prevents you from being blamed when something like this happens. You can say, I haven't touched it. It's archived.
And maybe it's hard to blame a guy that did something for free and has lost interest. But at the very least, if you have communication mechanisms, whatever repository, you as the maintainer should very publicly and say, I'm leaving this code. I'm no longer interested in it. Feel free to do what you will with it, but realize that I no longer control this, so use it as your own risk type thing. Maybe some sort of ending communication when you leave your own.
I'd agree with that. That's part of archiving a repository as well. So, I mean, I guess everyone involved here probably could have done something better. Luckily, the whole thing was caught before any wallets were actually exploited.
So and was it? I heard that they were actually, besides you said they were looking for wallets with a lot of coin, I heard there was even some specific wallets, maybe I read wrong, that they were actually looking for too.
It looked like it was just ones with a balance over 100 Bitcoin. So, and I think they were also looking ones for Bitcoin Cash, that spinoff of Bitcoin.
Gotcha.
No one cares about. Well, I'm going to get yelled at for that, but I don't care about it.
I don't much care about Bitcoin itself, so I get yelled at for all the time for that from you.
Seems like quite a few people are losing their interest in Bitcoin. It has gone from 6,000 to 2,000.
I still argue, as much as we don't like government control, there is actual value to having a body controlling the value of a currency.
Yeah. So interesting stuff this week.
Yeah, and by the way, I guess it goes without saying, you might have said it before, but we've talked a lot about, was it 2 years ago that we predicted an increase in supply chain attacks?
Yep.
We've kind of seen that over the past few years. And while this isn't the first time it's happening, I feel like the regularity, the volume of them going, and some of the sophistication in this case, kind of it being this weird social engineering aspect with switching maintainers too. So, you know, we still don't have resolution of if that whole Bloomberg hardware supply chain super micro attack is a real thing yet. But obviously, supply chain, especially software supply chain, is a big deal right now. So
don't trust anything.
I guess that's somewhat the advice. or what's the government? Trust but verify.
Yeah. If you have the ability to verify code or hardware or whatever you purchase, do it.
Yeah.
If you don't, just try and aim for a very trusted party that you're purchasing it from.
And you, by the way, this won't solve people that literally have taken over a code base and now are technically the real maintainers of it. But for things like, I don't know, CC Cleaner or open source repositories where you can download things, there are supply chain hacks that literally aren't like gaining control of the source, but might be injecting new tarballs on the download server. Mm-hmm. So something I see very few people do, but it's an option often in any place you get open source software, is using hashes to verify your download.
Yep.
So when you are getting, you know, code from a group that does maintain it and validate it, they usually have MD5, SHA, even SHA-2 now hashes to go with your download. You can at least verify that that really is coming from their server. Now, if they've been hacked, it's still up in the air.
But do it. Something you can do.
Yes. Many people don't. You should consider it. It's a small extra step.
Yep. And with that, let's move on to our main section now. So for our main section today, we've already talked about predictions a few times over the last month or so.
Shoot, we already hit on part of the predictions before the year even was out.
We had an episode where we reviewed our 2018 predictions. We had one where we showed off our 2019 predictions, which were videotaped too. If you haven't seen the video and you want to see the beautiful face and Corey Knockreiner behind this podcast.
Oh.
You should definitely
and
check it out.
And the amazing set that we always record our podcast in, right?
Yes, every single
with
time.
With our on-air site.
Post-apocalyptic bunker with my cardboard and LED.
And beautiful interwebs machine is actually recording.
Hey, it's still chugging along. Actually, I'm pretty sure
was it 24 baud?
I saved the floppy drive. Everything else has been recycled. Anyways, so we've talked about our predictions a few times.
I hope you kept that very important internet disk.
The floppy disk, the internet disk. We're technical people. Let's talk about the predictions that didn't make the cut. is what I'm trying to get at. So when we come up with our predictions every year, we usually have twice as many or three times as many that may not make it past the first round of brainstorming, but they're at least spitballed ideas out there. And sometimes we just whittle down even good ones that we think might
and
be a
I'll
little
give
too
you a little inside baseball too, in that we have a range of, you know, sometimes we're like, well, should we be realistic and just do the predictions that will really happen next year? But then some, I mean, often a lot of the more fun predictions are thinking 10, 20 years. Mm-hmm. So we range from kind of what we've been doing predictions a long time, so sometimes they seem very boring to us because we've done them before, to fantastical. And I think you'll agree that this year, while we actually think a lot could hit next year, we went a little edgier with our predictions,
too. They are all 100% accurate.
Absolutely.
Yes.
The interwebs will go down.
One way or another.
If it doesn't happen, you know what Mark's going to be doing
December 31st.
Yeah. And darn it, if you make it so I can't play with my new shiny gaming console on December 31st, I'll be pretty mad, Mark.
That's Lizard Squad's fault, not mine. So I figured for this episode, we could pick a few of the ones that just didn't quite make the cut to still talk about, because they are still relevant topics. They hit on actual security concerns, and they just weren't things that we thought might happen next year necessarily, or maybe they were ones that we've talked about quite a bit in the past. So I have a few that I wanted to bring up. Maybe Corey has a few as well. And the first one I wanted to talk about was a prediction that we had revolving around hacking IoT gateways.
But what are IoT gateways, Mark?
Oh, that I can explain. So IoT devices these days don't all always use Wi-Fi when it comes to wireless network connectivity. Sometimes they use other wireless protocols to create mesh networks. Zigbee is a really popular protocol. If you use like a smart doorbell and smart security system, it probably all connects together using Zigbee as the protocol. And it sets up this mesh network where all your devices can talk to each other. They all act as routers that then point to some way to get onto a traditional network. And that is the IoT gateway. Yep. It could be your Netgear router. It could be a specialized box. It could be your Amazon Home, whatever the heck their latest thing is. But either way, there is some device, sometimes more, that connects them all to a traditional TCP/IP network. And we see this, I mentioned, you know, home security. It's also used in utilities a lot as well. So yeah. Smart meters, gas meters, power meters, all connect in a mesh network over a city and then connect through an IoT gateway back onto a traditional network and the internet. So our prediction was that, or our prediction could have been that as more and more of these IoT smart devices are deployed out there, attackers aren't going to go after them individually. They're going to go after IoT gateways.
Yeah, we always talk about attack surface, and an attacker would want the thing that has the most potential, and that IoT gateway would be it.
Yeah.
I guess if we're downplaying this prediction, I actually think it's a very valid prediction, but even though we went to the edge, I actually think IoT gateways as consumer used, and while it will happen in utilities, I don't think it will be well targeted until it's consumer and business used. Mm-hmm. It's still low enough. I mean, the fact that we even kind of have to describe what IoT gateway is kind of shows that we didn't think it was quite time. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely one that I think will be a valid prediction. The question is just, is it next year? Is it 2 years from now? It has more to do with market dynamics of IoT gateways and which wireless signals kind of take off as the leading home automation or whatever.
And some things protocol. That the bad guys could do with these attacks, maybe they man in the middle all the traffic going out of these devices. So if it's your home security system, maybe they're able to trigger false alarms or cancel out alarms as they break into your house. They could also, maybe they're hacking the IoT side of it, the mesh network side, because they found a vulnerability, and that gives them a foothold on the traditional network side, and now they can hit your other device.
Or frankly, if it's the home automation system, just the view on, you know, what your home automation system's seeing is very valuable to the hackers as
well.
So
there are concerns about IoT gateways going forward.
Well, for sure.
Eventually, we might see some actual threats occur. Yeah. But like you said, it definitely still seems to be in its infancy in terms of adoption out there, which is why we didn't really include it as one of our 2019 predictions.
Yeah.
maybe in the future.
And we kind of gave IoT a break this year. I mean, we still are doing research. I think you've heard from me and Mark enough to know that IoT, individual devices, are still among the least secure out there. So expect plenty of individual IoT vulnerabilities, lots of consumer devices that will be easy to break into. That's going to continue for the foreseeable future. So
maybe just not IoT gateways quite yet.
Yep.
Do you have one you wanted to bring up?
There's a number. I was going to talk a little bit, if we're talking more about kind of topics, one of the topics we considered was, still kind of wireless, but it's more on the cellular side of hacking. What's going to be 5G is getting more popular now. Are there going to be any new cellular hack issues? I think we've talked in many shows and even in some predictions in the past about Signal System 7, an internal protocol that telecoms use, and weaknesses there. Mm-hmm. So, we were considering what are some of the new ways that cellular networks could get hacked. And ultimately, we didn't come across much. I mean, I think one of the things in our description was something we talked about, femtocells. If you don't know what a femtocell is, it's actually Internet of Things device.
Oh my
if
God.
You have some cellular provider and maybe at your office or maybe even in your home, for whatever reason, you may not have a good signal, you can actually call your telco provider and sometimes they can give you this. It's basically just a cellular router that you plug into your wired internet. And it kind of is a mini cell phone tower that not only will provide that telco's cellular signal to your house, but technically any phone within range of that femtocell could connect to it, get to the internet in your telco provider through that femtocell. So those hacks have happened in the past. We considered those. Ultimately, we didn't come with anything, but the main reason I wanted to bring up this topic is we've already seen a cellular hack that I think it was new. I wish we had almost predicted it. And this is the one I think where it was, we talked about it a bit. It was the 2FA, it was the leak.
Yeah.
Where we learned about third parties that actually, I often poo-pooed a little on Signal System 7 attacks, SS7 attacks, only because you really need elevated access to get to that protocol on telco networks. But that texting leak made me realize how many third parties are associated with cellular networks.
This was a few episodes back where attackers had gotten hold of a database that
essentially
acted as
a
gateway for SMS messages.
Yeah.
So web applications would send like one-time keys or password reset links through this gateway that would then go to actual text messages.
Yep. And so it made me think that, maybe the next supply chain attack into cellular data networks won't be any sort of protocol level thing, won't be any sort of femtocell thing, but will be just exposure of how many external third parties, small businesses with maybe less security practice and less expertise that happen to work with these cellular providers might be the weakness into the networks.
Yeah.
So that would have been a decent cellular prediction, cellular hack-related prediction.
On another topic that I feel like we've kind of hit over the head over the last few years in predictions revolves around cryptocurrency. And we had a prediction that almost made the cut, I'd say, in cryptojackers becoming the standard for botnets. And this kind of goes with botnets these days are becoming a lot more modularized. You'll see
these days. I'll let you finish. I'll give you my argument against making it a prediction.
All right. Well, these days, we see a lot more botnets that start with just a stager, and then they'll go download specific modules for whatever attack they're trying to do. And our prediction was going to be something like there'll just be a standard module for
cryptojacking would be the module.
Yep.
And my only argument against one, botnets have been modular for 10 years. Check out my malware analysis videos from 2010. It's a 1 hour series on botnets. If you
all
can find
10
it on
views
YouTube.
On YouTube.
Actually, it went up to 20,000 views.
Ooh, look at
you
me.
Might
I'm
be
boring.
Looking at the WatchGuard copy of it that was moved, but it got tons of views. I can show you people reusing it. But anyways, it's modularized. But I feel like cryptojacking has become a default module of botnets for the past year. I've seen it in some of the stores, and it's already there. I just thought it would be a bad prediction because it's kind of already happened. It's not it won't be new next year.
And it makes sense for the attackers, because if you're already going through the work of infecting a device, might as well add something that'll earn you a few pennies a day.
And I've said it before, the point of a botnet really is the Swiss Army knife aspect. It does, other than having backdoor access and giving control to an attacker of many computers at once, the payloads they can push to it are always going to differ and are always going to, they'll focus on the payloads that are making them the money during that period of time.
Yep.
So don't expect a botnet to ever do one thing. Sometimes the botnets will focus on banking man in the middles, where they might load a browser in the middle, you know, framework so that they can capture banking credentials. Sometimes they might just be looking for Bitcoin, you know, like either cryptojacking directly by using your resource, or for instance, the same thing the guy was doing to the JavaScript library, just kind of searching computers that they've infected for Bitcoin wallets and stealing the data there.
Yep.
So great prediction is, and it will happen next year, but only because it's already happened, in my opinion.
So smart prediction, not cool prediction.
An absolute trend. I would actually call this more an existing trend than a prediction.
That's
so
fair.
Do worry about it. It is real.
How about another one?
Oh, should we talk about... So one thing we talked a little bit about, or actually this came from some of the friends of the podcast and the threat team. I'm very interested in VR. It's one of the nerdy things I nerd out on.
He owns every single VR game ever made.
Pretty much now, and I'm getting there with VR platforms too. But I actually, you know, I was interested before, Mark, but you started it with being the first PSVR adopter, so I can't claim it only on me. But anyways, the question was, will there be any sort of VR hacks? All this new technology, will there be VR hacking? So yes, there's a possibility for it, but I think we're much too early. When you think about, is VR technology hackable? Well, my first argument about VR hacks was back when we first considered this, VR platforms were just computers and mobile phones. There's nothing VR was bringing to the equation other than maybe different software that added new attack surface. If you really think about it, the VR is just a display device. That's really all it is. There's a computer there that's powering the VR, or sometimes a mobile phone, and hacks are already happening against computers and mobile phones. So I didn't really think there was any aspects of VR that would add new hack surface. That is changing a little with new releases. There are now some standalone VR devices like Oculus Go, something called the Quest is coming out, where the computing power is built into the VR platform too, so they can be more direct targets as a VR device.
IoT.
Yes, it becomes an IoT device rather than something attached to a computer or phone. So then it becomes its own attack surface. That said, it's still essentially an Android device. So there's really no, can you hack it? Absolutely. But is it any different than any Android mobile hack? Maybe not. But then the next question is, okay, what does VR offer that a criminal could monetize? Right now, I don't think there's a ton, right? I mean, VR is mostly used for entertainment and gaming. It's not wide enough that you can make money from taking over someone's view of a virtual world. There are things you might be able to do in the future, some of it maybe around the way VR tracking works, how they track the headset or they track your body. Some of that has to do with LED sensors similar to Kinects. So maybe if they can, maybe if the VR tracking involves some sort of 3D mapping of a space, including your face, the same way Face ID works, perhaps stealing your likeness. It doesn't exist at all today in consumer land, but one day, one of the things VR will add is eye tracking. Tracking your retinas as you look around at different things on the display. There's reasons you would do that to save graphic resource, but could tracking what you're looking at as you browse the web be value of attackers? You know, maybe. I mean, one thing people will do in VR is browse the web like they normally do, and to know exactly what people are looking at on a web page could help for something nefarious. But the main point I think you can hear me getting to is I just can't figure out a motive for the criminal to target VR. So while there's nothing different about VR than any other IoT technology, it will be hackable. I just don't see a criminal motive yet.
It's going to take, like, you've seen the latest Blade Runner, right? So when we have like a VR projection system that has like our friend or whatever we want to call her. Maybe they're able to hack that and then like steal crap out of our house.
Yes, yes. And really, it will take mass consumer adoption before it becomes a target. That said, this might be subtle. I think most people out there know that when we say VR, I don't think we've defined it as virtual reality. And the definition is your entire view of the world is totally blocked out and everything you see is virtual. There is another up-and-coming technology that's popular too, AR, augmented reality.
The HoloLens.
Yeah. I was making sure it was augmented and not altered, but augmented reality. And that is for the same reasons it's not going to be hacked next year because it's not widely adopted. But I actually think that will have much more immediate criminal potential because AR is not blocking your view of the world. It's enhancing it. You might have seen the old Google HoloLens videos where
Microsoft HoloLens.
Yeah. Google has the Google Glass, otherwise known as Glass Somethings, the people that wear them. I won't say it for the polite audience, but that's what we all thought of people walking around with their Google Glasses. Anyways, I am interested in AR, and the vision of it is we could all be walking around and have a heads-up display on life where we can be looking at a can in the grocery store and we get its price and nutritional information. Or if you suck at remembering names, you can be walking around and it's telling you who everyone is around you.
Oh, that's going to be so helpful for me.
Yes, it is helpful. It's also kind of, I get scared of it too. But in any case, that's when hacking becomes really valuable because now you're using AR to interact with the real world and the social engineering possibilities just go off the chart. If I can control this information that's showing you and give you false information, you know, suddenly, imagine social engineering the future. I walk up to you as a person and I'm actually really criminal XYZ. But if I've hacked your AR, I can claim I'm some CEO of a company and make my phishing, scheme even more good.
And there will even be
more good. I know the best words.
You have the best words. Stable genius.
I did it for you, Mark.
I want to say there's probably even like more like less sophisticated attacks once AR takes off. I am sure at some point, once everyone's wearing Google Glass or whatever the heck the thing is going to be in 2049.
What are the, we have social engineering people that got the one that was for like Twitter or something, or was it Spotify? There was that the yellow glasses with the camera that was basically recording everything for
that
social media.
Sounds awful. So my point is, once everyone's wearing these heads-up displays, people are going to start advertising using them.
Absolutely.
And we already see bad guys use advertisements as a way to earn money, whether it be clickjacking. So maybe they like insert fake advertisements or something, or force you to view ones that they're under their control, or maybe they hijack the advertisement stream itself and hack your brain or something through it with a drive-by download. Who knows?
And going purely dystopian, I even talked about, if you have a heads-up display where you're getting told the speed limit while you're driving when there's no signs, it's very easy to suddenly say it's higher or lower than it is, so you can have some physical repercussions to this type of hacking too.
Yep.
So anyways, both of VR hacking and AR hacking will happen. I just don't think they're within the even next 5 years thing.
Probably
but
at least a decade.
To think about. Yeah. It's scary too. If you haven't read Snow Crash, great novel by one of my favorite authors, it explores virtual reality and AR as similar to Blade Runner and all the others, but a lot of negative potential as much as it's innovative and positive potential.
It's an oldie too, isn't it?
Oh yeah, Snow Crash is fantastic.
Awesome. Well, do you have any other predictions you want to bring up? Or
I predict in a couple of podcasts from now, I will make some sort of old pop statement again.
And I predict you will.
It seems to be a pretty consistent one.
I predict next podcast, you will still be a stable genius.
Oh, thank you very much, Mark.
Of course.
I love working with you when you compare me to my favorite.
I also predict I will be unemployed next week. Hey, everyone. Thank you again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed the episode, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions about today's episode or suggestions for future topics, you can tweet at me at @XORRO_ or Corey @SecAdept.
Yeah, but I want the compliments. He gets all the criticism.
Sure. Or the both of us at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you again next week.